Begin after six taps. One, two, three, four, five, six.
Bonjour, and thank you for listening to the FlixWise podcast. I'm your bumbling host, Lady P, no relation to Master P. And joining me today is overly enthusiastic tourist and FlixWise co-producer, Monsieur Martin Kessler.
Hello.
And making his triumphant return to FlixWise is the founder and editor of the website Criterion Blues and the co-host of the Criterion Close-Up podcast. Please welcome back to the show, Argyle sock collector, Mr. Aaron West.
No relation to Adam West. and don't own an Argyle sock either. But
no Argyle socks.
Maybe I need to buy some. Yeah.
I think maybe you should think about it. It's a good look.
Yeah.
And routing out our supersized panel is the head honcho over at the Criterion Reflections blog. A man whose every home appliance comes affixed with headlights. Ladies and gents, making his FlixWise debut is Monsieur David Blakesley. Welcome to the show, David.
Lady P, I am honored to be part of this esteemed panel, so thank you for the invitation. Yes.
Wonderful. We are so happy to have you.
Thank you.
On this show, we have the 43rd movie on the Sight and Sound Greatest of All Time list, Jacques Tati's 1967 hysterical classic, Playtime. I know what you're thinking. A comedy in the top 50. Impassible. Yes, believe it or not. Not only does the film elicit hearty laughter, but it's also a pretty pointed satire about modernity and consumerism. Anyway, listen up to hear how much fun we had during Playtime. Then, since at least half our panel are hardcore Criterion enthusiasts, you know, it's a good excuse to talk about the big CC. And the continued appeal of physical media in the digital streaming age. Finally, we'll close things out with a few final notes of positivity. All right, guys, shall we give this merry-go-round a twirl?
Let's get on it and ride.
Let's play.
Let's do it. First up, we're following the continuing misadventures of Monsieur Hulot as he makes his way around a labyrinthian city of the future in Jacques Tati's 1967 film, Playtime. The film follows Hulot on a trip to Paris, though this Paris bears little in common with the city of love that we've all seen in the movies and the travelogues. This Paris is made up primarily of big, boxy buildings made of steel and glass. It's so sterile and antiseptic that it becomes borderline dystopic, with its inhabitants separate and disconnected from each other and the past. Indeed, the typical denoters of the city's cultural history, like, say, the Eiffel Tower, are only glimpsed in passing, as reflections on the walls of buildings or car windows. The film initially casts Hulot as the audience surrogate. We watch him try and navigate nondescript office buildings and stumble through awkward encounters with pushy salesmen and American sightseers. But as the film progresses, Hulot starts to recede from the forefront. In fact, he almost becomes incidental as Tati widens his scope to showcase all the increasingly ridiculous leisure activities of the Parisian bourgeoisie. As I mentioned in the opening, this is the 43rd movie on the Sight and Sound Critics poll. An impressive feat for any film, but especially for a comedy. But is it really as funny as all that? We shall discuss. First question. Do you like Playtime? I feel, again, very silly asking you all this because I know with some certainty that you're all pretty big fans of this film, but I'm going to ask you anyway. Let's start with Aaron.
I can't stand this. No, I love
know.
This movie.
Terrible.
This is one of my favorite movies of all time. So, yeah, it's a big fan.
So when did you first see it and how did you end up falling in love with it?
You know, what's weird is this was actually my first tattoo, and I recommend that this is not people's first tattoo. I would recommend go in the Hulot sequence with Holiday and then Uncle and then Playtime. But I saw this first, and it's a marvel. I was blown away by it, and you know, it's of course it's slower paced, so it's the first time I really really liked it. I found some segments enjoyable, but then the second and third time, you know, like the restaurant scene, there's so much density in that scene. It's like the latter third of the movie. So it's just grown in appreciation, and I love the movie. And it's one I can just put on in the background, you know, while I'm doing chores. It's just a very uplifting movie for me. So,
all right, David, How did you first encounter Playtime?
Okay, well, I first encountered Playtime back in 2006 when the Criterion Collection was re-releasing it on DVD at the time. And this is about a year or so after I started paying pretty close to like new releases and just, you know, following Criterion online and beginning to build my own little media collection there. So, and we'll talk about that all later. But yeah, I just read a lot of enthusiasm about this upcoming release. So I had actually checked out Monsieur Hulot's Holiday from my local library and found that pretty charming and pretty wonderful. And so I was really eager. So I actually went out and bought Playtime on DVD as a blind buy. And, you know, popped it in and watched it. And it was like, it was interesting and definitely unique. It wasn't the uproarious laugh fest that I was maybe led to think it was. And I also, thinking back now, watched it on an old CRT TV, you know, like probably a 32-inch TV or something like that. But not in the best quality. And so I don't think I realized just how packed with information the film was until, you know, several years later when I upgraded my TV, got a wider monitor, and had a chance to kind of watch it in better resolution. And so, yeah, my fondness wasn't immediate. I mean, I liked it. It was interesting, but it's grown, you know, exponentially over the last couple of years. I actually took it to work with me one day and watched it on about a 12-foot wide screen that we have for like trainings and things like that. So I got to see it in pretty nice, big picture. I've never seen it theatrically, unfortunately, but I'd jump at the chance if I ever saw it coming within a few hundred miles of my home. So yeah.
Yeah. 70mm. I'm with you.
Yeah, for sure. I'd definitely make the long drive and book a hotel room or whatever just to have that experience. But I love the film. As I said in my blog, this isn't just a movie. This is a cosmos to be entered into and just really savored. And so, maybe there's bigger fans out there, but I think I'm about as enthusiastic about this one as I could be. This is a masterpiece. I guess we're going to let Martin weigh in, maybe.
All right, Martin, how about you?
Yeah, I like Playtime a lot, but it wasn't exactly love at first sight for me either. I think I sort of got into Tati through an animated film a few years ago, The Illusionist, which was based on one of his unfinished films. And I became very interested and saw Monsieur Hulot's Vacation and Mon Oncle. And then I watched Playtime and I was just kind of baffled by it at first. I didn't really like it. I didn't find it. I mean, I found parts of it funny, but I sort of found it weirdly distancing. And it wasn't really until it kind of lingered in my mind and I decided to rewatch it again. And then I lucked out and saw it on a theater maybe 2 or 3 years ago. And that's really when it started to come into focus for me as being a very detailed, choreographed film. And I think, like, as somebody who spent most of my life in the country, it really does capture that overwhelming experience of being in a city for the first time, which I like a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Plus, like, there's just not really any other comedy made like this. Like, I think it's special for that. Like, this is not how you'd make a comedy.
I think with Monsieur Hulot's Holiday, you know, that's just kind of a charming, you know, everybody's been to the beach, everybody's, you know, had their vacations, and so you sort of, you know, you can attune to the things that happen there. And with Mon Oncle, it's kind of a parody of suburbia and futurism, and the humor is a lot more kind of right there and ready to be laughed at. There's a real weird subtlety to Playtime and this kind of nonlinear, just sort of jump in and look around and notice things comedy, where a lot of the funniest jokes are up in the, you know, upper, you know, left-hand corner of the screen, you know, not right in front of you. And there's no obvious laugh lines. It's not just kind of, you know, I mean, there's a few slapstick bits, but really it's very subtle. So you have to kind of reattune your sensibilities. Like Martin said, this isn't your typical comedy, but once you get on it, it's like, it's genius.
Yeah. And if you watch it on a small DVD where you can't really see the details, you get about 12 big laughs out of the film, which isn't much for a movie that's over 2 hours. So I think, like, you really do need to see it bigger to start picking up all the small details and really realizing that there's something funny in almost every frame of the film.
Yeah. The restaurant scene in particular just packed the gills. Mm-hmm. So much detail.
Just the fish alone, I think.
Merits widescreen.
15 yeah. laughs there. I can't.
Exactly, at least. But we should talk more about Monsieur Hulot and who is that character and what is he doing in this film as opposed to some of the earlier films. So we've mentioned Monsieur Hulot's Holiday and Mon Oncle and my crack at the beginning about Argyle socks. That's one of the trademarks of this character. We know him. He's sort of like a Chaplin-esque figure in that you know him as soon as you see him. But what is the source of the humor?
Well, Hulot, kind of as you guys were talking about, I think there's a progression with not just the films, but with the character from Holiday and Uncle to Playtime. And I think he's developed as sort of, I wouldn't say uncomfortable in his own skin, but really uncomfortable in his surroundings. And that's where the sort of this bumbling slapstick comes in, you know, with the tennis and Holiday and with the fish in Mon Oncle, which... is very, very funny. Now, he's less of a fixture in Playtime, and I know just from my own research that that was deliberate because he wanted it to be less about him. But I think he still serves as sort of the conduit to where he expresses his message, which I think is sort of, it's complicated, but I think it's more anti-modernity and more traditional, and just by him being, witnessing things like the expo and these inventions and not really understanding and sometimes being funny or whether it's the voyeuristic windows, going in that apartment. He just by him going from place to place and being out of place, he sort of colors the film, not just with humor, but also with awkwardness and anti modernity, I guess.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
It's interesting that you sort of characterize it that way, because I was thinking how, the way he shows modern life, it's not all bad either. I think, he does ridicule it, but I think he's showing that it's complicated. It can alienate us, isolate us, or it can bring us together, like at the party at the end, the nightclub at the end. You know, it can be ugly but also beautiful, like see the street lamps looking like flowers. Right. I think he's sort of not operating on a clear thesis so much as he is just heightening it to better consider it. I think maybe Mon Oncle is more actually a critique of modern life than Playtime is.
That's why I said it was complicated, because I think Playtime is more about finding humanity within modernity. And as you mentioned, we're already to the end of the film, but with the restaurant where that sequence goes and how it breaks down, and that's where the real joy begins, and then the present and the light bulbs. Yeah, he does show that there are simple pleasures that can be found in this modern world, and if we cling to those, we'll be happy. So actually, even though it's some people might see it as a pessimistic critique, and I think in some ways it is, about maybe inventions and gadgets and this sort of thing, I do see it as an uplifting and joyous film, and I get a kick out of it. That's part of why.
I see it more like the world is changing around him and around all of us, and so it is kind of like what Aaron said, finding your place in it. You can't really halt progress. You can't really, salvage or return to the good old days. How do you avoid, getting locked into the grid and still find that freedom and spontaneity? And I guess that's, one of the, observations that I've picked up from other critics and writers is the characters all kind of move in straight lines and turn at right angles at the beginning of the film, and things become looser and more rounded, more curved, more organic, as they kind of break out of that template towards the end, and a little touch of freedom and anarchy and chaos takes over, and there's a place for that even in this new kind of high tech modern world that we're all moving forward into, even in the mid 1960s.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it seems to me like it is kind of. It's a critique of modern life, but it's also, it's not like a polemic where he's like railing against modernity. It's more like, isn't this hilarious? Like, look at us modern humans and what we've done.
Sure.
Well, I think too, unlike something like maybe Chaplin's Modern Times, I think he also does take some pleasure in it too. Like, it's hard to imagine somebody who's very much against the modern architecture and modern ideas so lovingly creating the set design. And like, I think like he's taking a lot of pleasure in it too. I think he sort of knows some of it's ridiculous, but I think there's an allure to it, which like I think like I sort of think of this as a modernist film, even though it's also critiquing modernism, maybe.
How to explain?
Well, I think like just in the design, I'm admiring the construction of the gags almost in the same way that I'd admire the exterior of like a piece of modernist architecture. I think like he's sort of letting you see the construction of things,
the choreography, the planning, the structure that is very modernistic. That goes back to, you know, like the Joyce and Ulysses and Finnegan's Wake and all those other kind of imposing classics, where there's so much artifice and there's so much, you know, planning and rigor. And even the title of the film, Playtime, which is the actual title, it's not a translation from the French. Yeah, so he's using the English words. I mean, that is this is a playful, you know, experience that he's trying to create for his audience. But again, it's not slapstick comedy. This is not It's a Mad, 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 Mad World, you know, where everything's just kind of like blowing up in your face. And I think that's one of the reasons why this film just didn't do very well commercially. They wanted Monsieur Hulot's, you know, cutesy folksiness, and he just wasn't really willing to give it to him. And this sterility and this abstraction, it just requires a certain sort of sensibility to relate to it. And even seeing it in the big screen in 65, 70 millimeter back in the day, you know, must not have been quite enough to connect with the mass audience at that time. Not to mention the fact that you spent so much money making it.
I mean, I feel bad that it flopped, but at the same time, I can completely understand, like, why a comedy that needs to be watched more than once, that sort of demands you come to it on its own terms, then it comes to you on your terms, like, why that would flop. It's it's unfortunate.
Especially
but, like,
in the original 150
minutes or something like that. It's like such an uncompromised idea of what a comedy is.
And like you mentioned, the jokes are subtle, and I think Mon Oncle was almost over the top, and I think it was more, you know, laugh out loud kind of funny, whereas this is kind of sly, subtle reference funny. And you know, and once you kind of get what he's saying, a little like walking down the long hallway, when you first see it, you don't really understand what the situation is, but you know, every time I see it again, I look forward to that long walk.
or Mr. Jaffard and Mr. Lax talking to each other, you know, three booths apart, but they've got to make this long trek, you know, through the labyrinth of all the cubicles to find a file that's in a drawer that's like on the other side of the wall. It's like, you know, if you're distracted at all or just kind of looking away, you're not going to even get the joke, or even just little subtle things. You know, the guy with the tall floor lamp, and he just kind of shows up every few minutes, or you know every 10-15 minutes. It's like, what is that all about, you know? So it's noticing those little quirky bits and characters who just sort of, you know, flitter in and out of the scene that makes this just, you know, so fascinating. And it's almost like it's a film that could just be played on a loop, you know, to reconnect the pieces you know, from beginning to end.
I mean, because it doesn't draw your attention to specific places or specific lines of dialogue, it sort of lets your mind wander while you're watching it, and it almost recreates the experience of being out in public in the city in real life and noticing some funny conversation or some funny interaction. I think it turns you into an active viewer, which is sort of a big feat, I think, for any film.
Yeah. Oh, definitely.
Well, and I think the film triggers this kind of existential experience. I mean, you sort of become aware of yourself as a person watching a film, but then you become aware of yourself as a person living life and noticing the details and the oddities going on around you just when you're outside of the theater. And I think that's just kind of another sort of deeper appreciation of the film, is that, you know, Tati, you know, kind of built this whole city to create this work of art, which really just at its core, it kind of calls us just to notice the peculiarities of existence itself. That's kind of the deeper application of the film, I guess.
Do you guys feel like at all like some of the jokes are at your expense?
Is it weird that I thought a little bit of our Satan Tango episode watching this, when you said like it's like watching people in an ant farm. It like it does have that kind of feeling sometimes where like yeah. you're at such a huge distance.
Yeah.
And there are some as an American, I think there are some American jokes, and I wouldn't say anti-American. I don't know Tati's feelings about America, but you know, in the scene where he's sitting with the businessman who I think
Mr.
represents
Lax, it, yeah,
right. Mr. Lax, thank you. That's very American, and of course the tourists are American too, and he just kind of makes fun of the tourist industry, and I think that's where we see the reflections of Sacré-Cœur and Eiffel Tower, of course, whereas they're staying in these little glass buildings. They don't, and what's funny is they show the posters of other cities, and you see the same glass buildings.
Yeah. I love that. Yes. Yeah.
It rings so true, though. It's hilarious because it's absolutely accurate. And I'm finding increasingly, as when I travel, that all major cities are in some ways alike these days. It's all the same stores. The architecture is generally the same. And while each individual city has its landmark and its whatever history has been preserved, yeah. there's the same stalls trying to sell you the same mm-hmm. junk.
Right. The old stuff is unique, but the new stuff is all the same. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So it's as pointed and accurate today as it was when he was making it, perhaps even more so.
I always kind of like it when a successful comedic artist builds up enough clout and credibility that they can make a commercial personal project that's expensive and ambitious that sort of shoots them in the foot financially. Like, I thought a lot about Buster Keaton's The General watching this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Chaplin's Monsieur Verdu kind of comes to mind as you're talking about that. I mean, he definitely changed his character, gave up the little tramp, and, you know, made a comedy about a serial killer, you know.
I mean, these films are almost never commercially successful, but later on, they're often admired for the artistry.
Well, for the risk that they take.
The risk, exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, this is a film that if somebody comes and says, you know, I don't really get it, I don't really like it, it doesn't really bother me because I don't think it's expecting mm-hmm. you to like mm-hmm. it right off the bat. You know, my recommendation would be just to hang in there with it. You know, if there's anything that intrigues you about it, if you're one of those viewers that feels like, yeah, maybe this is overhyped or just didn't click with me, you know, well, just, you know, give it some time. And, you know, and I guess, you know, maybe for some people, they're just not, you know, into Tati's style of comedy, or they just want something else when they watch films. But yeah, this to me, there are stretches where, you know, I guess if you want to critique, you know, there are some pieces that work better than others, but I just find the whole thing just a tantalizing marvel. So I just enjoy it through and through.
Yeah, it's sort of the way it's constructed, and just how antiseptic it is, like everything's so removed. It kind of like facilitates isolation. Like you're not meant to talk or see other people, but it kind of, as I was watching it, reminded me of Star Trek. and that may seem odd, but I think part of that is in the sound design.
Yeah, there's a lot of background humming going on.
Yeah,
that kind of throbbing of machinery, right?
Yeah, and like, especially, I remember seeing in the theater, the ambient noise, sometimes it's louder than the people talking, the way it's mixed. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, part of shooting in 70mm or 470mm is you get the extra space for the soundtrack. So this has, like, such an elaborate mixed soundtrack where sometimes the voices are very low and they kind of come up and down, and you have that, like, really loud humming, or you hear engines or electric things just overbearing. Or sometimes, too, there's, like, great
bloops.
Little... I love sometimes, like, the little tiny sounds you don't necessarily hear on DVD. Like, when the nuns are walking with those flapping hats, there's this little, like, whooshing sound that accompanies them that cracks me up.
Yeah.
But it's such a rich soundtrack, especially for the time period.
Yeah, even though it seems like a quiet film, this is definitely one where we want to crank the volume up a little bit, just because, you're right, Tati is mixing just as many gags into the sound mix. And this is all post-production dub too. It was filmed pretty much as a silent movie, so every sound that you hear was deliberately placed there. There wasn't anything that's picked up on the set, you know, just in the process of, you know, filming with mics or anything like that.
And his icons were Chaplin and Keaton, and of course back then, of course, they played natural, or they played real sound as the films were being exhibited. But I think he sort of mimics some of the sounds that they would use. Well, more accentuates them, because in 67 they had the technology to have that ambient noise, whereas of course Keaton didn't. Mm-hmm. But it really is a silent film, just with great sound effects.
Yeah, Pauline, your comment about how it sort of reminds you of Star Trek, I think is also very fitting, just because this is the era. I mean, I was born in 61, so I kind of have a childhood memory of this kind of cities of the future kind of thing, you know, with the brushed steel and the chrome and the glass and just the slickness. And I think another film from that same era that it does bear an affinity is 2001: A Space Odyssey, in its own vision of, you know, the relatively near future at that time of how, you know, technology and life and efficiency and the kind of the sterility was just going to continue progressing. And of course, you know, we know that looking back on our own lives that things didn't exactly go that way, but that was the kind of the prevailing mentality of how the cities of the future would be structured. I mean, just look at the, you know, covers of old science fiction paperbacks for some of those images and some of that kind of aesthetic to come through. And so, yeah, that's a very interesting comparison.
Well, since it's coming up, the filmmaker that this reminds me a lot of from the 60s is Ozu's later films, like the sort of muted color palettes, oh, yeah, with like dabs of red, the way he frames, yeah, people, mm-hmm, with these geometric patterns, the kind of tone and view of modernity. I find certain things very similar. Like when I'm watching Late Autumn, I'll get like Playtime deja vu.
Nice.
Or
yeah.
Vice versa.
That's good.
And when I watch an Ozu film, I feel a sort of serenity. Where, and mm-hmm, I actually have the same feeling when I watch a Tati film.
Yeah, this gracefulness.
Only I laugh more. Well,
yeah, I mean,
although like Autumn films, Afternoon has some funny.
Some of them
film,
are pretty funny. I mean, and like, yeah, Playtime, it does have like little melancholy moments too, I find. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not like a big drama, but you know, I get a little heart twinge near the end. It's
when Hulot and Barbara can't quite reconnect, he wants to get her this little gift, and it gets to her, but she's moving on, he's left behind. And yeah, there is a little bit of wistfulness at these kind of relationships that never quite, you know, reach their culmination, but there's definitely a fondness there. And so, time is passing, life is passing, the rules of society and technology kind of keep us, like you say, separate from each other. And alas, isn't that how it is? It's very Ozu-like, you know, right?
What do you guys make of the fact that he keeps running into army buddies and there's all these kind of misconnections? It's kind of peculiar, like you've been through so much together and now suddenly you're in this big city.
Well, and it's kind of weird because I never think of Hulot as an ex-soldier, you know, but I guess maybe guys of Tati's generation all were enlisted at some point, you know, in the 1940s, and so it's just everybody sort of had their obligatory national service to do. So yeah, I think it's just another generational marker, you know, he's recognizing that, you know, especially by 64, 65, 66, as they're making this film, you know, life is becoming about the younger people now. They're kind of taking over the popular consciousness, the baby boomers, and fashions, and film, and, you know, Tati's recognizing, you know, he's kind of the older guard now, so maybe he's casting himself that way as well.
And I think it emphasizes the isolation that you touched on, Pauline, in that it's about losing connections. He has lost connections with these old army buddies, and you know he can't reconnect with them. It just, the city doesn't allow it. It's too big, and they just, for whatever reason, can't. Or he doesn't want to in many cases. Yeah.
There are too many other distractions, like, for instance, the television.
Right, right. and then with the, and then trying to make new connections, you know, I think he connected more with the people that were not in his life in the restaurant. You know, even the American, Barbara, male American, I forget his name, the one that was really funny in the restaurant. Over-the-top stereotypical.
We're going to have
American.
A hot time tonight.
Yeah, that guy. Yeah. It was great.
Is there anything else that we wanted to mention before I ask the final question?
Well, maybe we should just talk about the restaurant scene. I mean, it's such a huge portion of the film, just to unpack that a little bit. It is kind of the big set piece that everything kind of, you know, draws into. I guess there's also the night scene and the apartment, the little, you know, the kind of the the running gag of the two apartments next to each other and the characters, you know, seeming as if they're interacting with each other, really, though, mm-hmm. they're just watching their TVs. Right. That's a nice piece of choreography there. But, yeah, I guess the restaurant scene is just loaded. You know, you've basically got everything coming to a head there. But it's just the music, I guess, you know, we've talked about the sound design, but just the music and the way it sort of just kicks in and just animates. And just trying to get my head around, how do you really direct this really crowded room of people who are all doing so many different things? It's not like a ballroom dance where everybody's kind of, you know, rehearsing their stuff and they're all moving in syncopation or in unison with each other, but they're really just going in so many different directions. And this is another thing that makes the film so rewatchable. I've probably watched it probably 10 times within the last, you know, 2 or 3 years. And it's just like, I hadn't noticed that before. You know, it's just loaded. And just to think, you know, Tati really dreamed all this stuff up. You know, you think, well, you know, he sure could have made more movies, but, you know, he didn't make that many films, but he sure loaded a lot into this one in particular.
Yeah.
And a lot of those are long takes, too, in the restaurants. So, yeah, very the choreography itself is just not just in the restaurant scene, but throughout the film, even with the trade show. Yeah, it's very meticulously put together. And I think we know that Tati really was a perfectionist, too, which, lucky for us.
Yeah, I think in that scene, I think maybe that's where we get some of the wistfulness that you mentioned. Mm-hmm. Like we get the frenzied, like big jazz age or rock and roll age scene where everyone's kind of dancing and doing mm-hmm. their weird, I don't know, Watusi or whatever. but the scene culminates with the American tourist Barbara, I think. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Sitting at the piano playing some old-fashioned Parisian or French standard.
Right.
And everyone takes a minute to pause and slow down. And so maybe that's, if not wistfulness, maybe that's where some of the hopefulness comes from. Like, all is not lost. There's this
restaurant that's kind of like this big, you know, fancy pants, you know, gourmet experience. But what happens when that kind of section of the ceiling falls down and kind of all those little wood slats or panels are kind of suspended by wires, the American kind of the rambunctious business guy, he sort of creates a little sidewalk cafe mini environment within this restaurant. So that's where you've got to kind of open the gate and let people in. And he's also sort of serving as a maitre d', like who are the real people who kind of belong in this little exclusive back corner of the restaurant. So it's a very subtle little thing that he's doing there, but it's very touching because that's kind of where the intimacy is created in this place that otherwise is fairly manic and impersonal.
I thought that seems maybe a little bit a social commentary too, him letting people into like a little sub club, because right. like just before that, I think it's one of the men who's in the jazz band comes along, and I think like they weren't going to let him into the restaurant probably because he was black, and then he turns around right. and he has the tuxedo, and then he realized like he belongs. So like I sort of wondered if like you have a marking on your back, like you can come in or you can stay out, was maybe a little bit Tati commenting on the.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was almost a kind of a shared experience too. You know, the people with the crown on their backs had endured this this terror of a restaurant falling apart, so they're allowed. That's the price of admission. If you got served the fish, you can get into this little
paid
side
your dues,
party,
right? Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
All right. Well, it sounds like we all quite enjoy this film, but. It is the 43rd movie on the Sight and Sound critics poll. Do we think that's too high? Is that too low? What do you think?
I'm glad it's this high. I'm sort of a little bit surprised because I know like it wasn't received well, and it's a film that sort of takes a little while to come to terms with. So I'm glad that however many critics could enjoy this film enough to put it on their lists.
And I think it's just a few spots above City Lights, if I remember right.
Mm-hmm,
I don't know if there are any Chaplins ahead of it, which is actually interesting. But I think 43 is right, but I would probably put a Chaplin ahead of it. And I think
I guess if you're talking about overall maybe historic impact, I mean, I honestly have not studied the Sight and Sound list close enough to see whether or not, I mean, is this for, you know, kind of a historic merit where it resonates in the you know, the grand story of cinema, or is just about sheer entertainment value, and on a deeper level. I'm not saying, you know, just, you know, mass entertainment, you know, like a Star Wars, Lord of the Rings type of thing. But to me, I mean, there, as I look at some of the films ranked higher, I certainly recognize their historic significance, but I almost defy people to say, would you really want to watch some of those films more often than this one? You know, I could put this in my top 25 easily, just because I get so much pleasure from revisiting it. And there are certainly great films that you admire everything that they achieve, but it's like, okay, I've seen that. I think I've gotten my satisfaction out of it, and let's move on to other things. I can come back to Playtime pretty much whenever.
Yeah,
yeah, I see the General is ahead of it, which, and that's, I agree with that. That's another one I can come back to a lot.
Like, I won't be watching Jean Dielman 23K de Converse today.
Oh, come on, David.
Ouch!
I respect it. I admired it. Yeah.
Well, even within Tati's own body of work, I think like I wouldn't say Playtime's Tati's funniest film, but I think like I'm almost admiring it more for the craft of filmmaking. Like, I think if you go like. Yeah. You know, on a laugh for laugh basis, probably Mr. Hulot's Holiday probably Mr. Hulot's Holiday makes me laugh the most.
Love that film more than I love Playtime, because it just is so exquisitely adorable and just reminds me of so many happy vacations and times at the beach I've had. And that is a truly perfect film.
Even though I love Holiday and I agree that it's near perfect film, I think Playtime is his most ambitious, and I think it's really the culmination of his life's work. So I think this is punctuating Tati's, what Tati gave to cinema.
Absolutely. Hear, hear. For our next topic, we're going to talk about something we haven't really addressed on the show before. Movies as collector's items. As I mentioned at the top of the show, two of today's panelists have blogs devoted entirely to the Criterion Collection's ever-expanding list of DVD and Blu-ray titles, and they are not alone. Criterion has a reputation as the gold standard in movie preservation and restoration for home release, and they have the following to prove it. And so I thought we could talk about what it is specifically about Criterion and perhaps other specialty DVD and Blu-ray distributors that makes people want to own physical copies of all the movies in these libraries. So, Aaron?
Yes, ma'am.
Can you just, like, for my parents, who are probably the only people listening who don't know what the Criterion Collection is, can you maybe just, like, give a brief overview of, like, what is the Criterion Collection?
Sure. It's just really a label, a boutique label that releases physical media, and actually not just physical, but physical and streaming media, and they focus generally on art house, some cult cinema, some foreign, independent, sometimes pretty much documentary, pretty much anything that I guess film snobs like us would like. And there's a lot of overlap with the Sight and Sound list. I think they do their library represents, you know, a good portion of what a lot of people would consider the greatest films of all time. Mm-hmm. I think that's why they're so well known by us. They're known for their packaging, the very nice cover art, the very immaculate, usually immaculate packaging. Some would debate that. And they have a lot of supplements. So they call them film history in a box sometimes, because in fact, Tati is a great example. The Tati box set, you learn so much about the background, about Tativille, about all that went into the film. It is like taking a course on a director or a film when you engage with one of their releases. So,
yeah, and that box set is actually everything. It's called the Complete Jacques Tati. So, you know, in his particular case, you've got, you know, his whole oeuvre right there in one item that you can just purchase off the shelf and take home with you. But, you know, I got into the Criterion Collection in the early 2000s, just started kind of noticing that some of these movies, you know, that I was just discovering and just becoming a little bit more focused on cinema, not just as, you know, popcorn munching, you know, matinee fare to take my kids and, you know, family to, but really, you know, the whole combination of all the arts, you know, the acting, the photography, the music, the set design, the writing, obviously the stories. You know, I started really appreciating cinema on that level years ago. And as I was, you know, either purchasing films or rent, you know, borrowing them from the library, just noticed this Criterion Collection thing on the side, of a lot of the cases, and that just got me looking more closely at this company, and it just became to me just kind of a fascination in the middle parts of the 2000s, where I just started building this collection. And you know, I kind of come from the old school of, you know, collecting record albums or collecting paperback books or collecting comics or whatever, and you know, so became a little bit older and had a little bit more disposable income. Collecting DVDs and Blu-rays just became a little bit more of a hobby of mine. And then about 2008 or so, I just, you know, as I started, you know, reading more about film criticism and just, you know, some of the literature that had grown out of, you know, the appreciation of cinema, yeah, I started, you know, thinking, well, you know, I like to write. And as far as blogging is concerned, it was a way for me to focus my viewing. I didn't want to just watch a movie and say, wow, that was pretty awesome, but really think, well, what did this film say to me? What did this, you know, what's this film trying to communicate? Who is the guy or who are the people behind making this movie? And that's what got me to start, you know, blogging. So it was really more of a way of taking notes and then turning them into something that might be worth reading for somebody else who was curious to know more about that film. And that's where my blog first came from. And then I just kind of came up with this notion that, you know, to sort of do my ongoing adult education, so to speak, I was just going to kind of go back to the beginning. I made a big spreadsheet that had all these films listed in the order of their original release date, and I just started working my way through it. So, you know, through that blog, it kind of got me connected to the Criterion Cast website, you know, which is, you know, Ryan Gallagher and some of his associates who were kind of doing their own thing from their own kind of fan perspective. And I started writing a column for their site, and then we got into podcasting with the Eclipse Viewer, which looks at kind of a specialized sideline of the Criterion Collection, some of the more obscure films that they release on DVD-only box sets. And so my friend Trevor Barrett and I do that. I was doing it with another guy named Rob Nishimura back in 2012. We did that for about, I don't know, 6-7 months or so, and then he decided he wanted to move on to other things. And then, you know, Trevor kind of got me talking, and we revived our podcast, and it's just kind of grown into this little, you know, hobby, this little thing I'm involved with. And it's been a lot of fun just getting to know other cinephiles out there online, and occasionally meeting people face to face. And you know, so it's been a great hobby for me. I've got this nice fat wall of DVDs and Blu-rays, and and it's been a lot of fun to get to know people and to share our excitement and intrigue as they release new titles. And you know, Criterion, I one of the things I really appreciate about them as a company is that they are very adventurous. They're not strictly art house. They're not strictly, you know, predictable. They take cinema and their appreciation of great films in new directions, even to the point where sometimes they introduce material that might be, you know, kind of controversial or puzzling. I mean, thinking about like a Jellyfish Eyes, a recent Japanese film that has a kind of a lot of anime characteristics and kind of caters to the younger set. And you know, so there's a lot of dialogue, there's a lot of creative conversation as to why they would put their imprint on certain films. And I just like the vitality of this little niche scene that's developed around that label.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what is it, I mean, in this digital age, why continue to buy the physical copy of the DVD or the Blu-ray?
Well, that's a great question, and I think that's a question everybody's going to be asking themselves for the next 10, 20 years.
Yeah, I think there will be that point, you're right, where we're going to have to decide, do you have to have everything? But go ahead, Aaron, I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Oh, that's okay. For me, it's really twofold. Part of it is, as David sort of touched on or hinted on, is as Criterion does take risks and they curate a set of movies. So not only the films on the Sight and Sound, but sometimes a riskier film like a Jellyfish Eyes or maybe like a Special Day, an Italian film that I wouldn't otherwise, or Robert Drew documentaries that I probably wouldn't otherwise see. So, and I generally trust what they release, and so I think it's kind of like the modern day library. You know, people used to like to have, well, a lot of people still do like to have books in on shelves, and I am one of them. But, you know, this is yet another form of collecting, having something to look at in your house that and admire. But also, I'm a little bit of a hi-fi presentation kind of, I guess geek, yeah.
So nothing wrong, say it proud.
So if I stream Playtime, you know, I'm sure it would look fine, but I would much rather watch it on a big screen and on a Blu-ray copy and maybe eventually on a 4K UHD Blu-ray copy, although I'm not quite ready for that yet. I tend to gravitate, even when I sometimes, if there's a movie on Netflix, you know, that's not on the Criterion, a lot of times I'll try to find the Blu-ray through like Netflix disc, or maybe a cheap, cheap on Amazon or something, just because I prefer seeing a better quality print, and I think I appreciate the movie more. And
I mean, there's a dependability to physical media that you can curate your own tastes and build up your little library of films that you like, and you know that they're not going to go off Netflix. You know that they're not going to buffer when your internet's slow, or you're not going to have a YouTube ad. It's sort of there, and you can watch it intact in kind of the best way.
Yeah,
possible for the time being, anyway.
just the convenience of having a booklet or an essay of a well written article, and also the supplements. I mean, you don't get that stuff with streaming. Sometimes you might get a few supplements, but there's a lot of interesting TV interviews from the 1960s or trailers that kind of, you know, highlight how the film was presented to its original audience, or, you know, radio adaptations that are really audio only.
My favorite are the audio commentaries. Like,
yeah, well, of course. Well,
that's sort of the precursor to podcasting, but...
Yeah. Criterion invented those, really, too, with the laser discs. So that's another... they've actually...
Right.
And they have a reputation, and they have a great brand. They're tremendous at their marketing.
Yeah, or even Playtime, you know, you've got two different audio tracks, both of which Tati authorized, you know, one for the French audience, one for the international, and there are actually differences in the sound effects, and so, you know, you've got some different options at your disposal, which you're just not going to get through a stream. I don't know of any streaming services that are that meticulous about gathering everything to do with a particular film and saying, okay, you can search the menu and do your background research if you just want to sort of see, you know, more than just the making of or the trailer for the film. So, you know, and then there's the artwork, just the presentation, just the pleasure of holding this kind of package in your hand that says, okay, that's not just a movie, it's the document of what kind of an impact this particular film made, whether it's a big blockbuster or whether it's some obscure, you know, rarity, something that, you know, really came from the underground fringes of, you know, radical experimental cinema in the 1960s, which, you know, there's no commercial interest for a Netflix or a Hulu to, you know, carry the films of, you know, Hollis Frampton or Stan Brakhage or whoever you might want to throw out there from that avant-garde camp. So, you know, Criterion, they cover a vast range, and what they do very well. So I'm happy to be a supporter and a cheerleader, you know, and a collector.
And he owns all of them, by the way. I own all the Blu-rays. David, is that correct,
yeah,
David?
You have them, yeah, all? Yeah, I got in pretty much almost towards the last stage. I mean, some people have been collecting these things for, you know, decades, literally. But when I started kind of seriously amassing my collection in like 2007, 08, 09, it was still at a time, I mean, there were still a number of DVDs that were out of print and starting to get a little bit pricey, but... that would be quite an undertaking these days to just say, I'm going to get all of them.
How do you feel about maybe buying films that don't necessarily appeal to you? Do you just sort of take it as a seal of approval from Criterion that, you know, this film has some worth, that it's worth taking a look at, even if it's not necessarily up your alley? Or,
you know, I haven't been, like, completely dismayed or, you know, to the point of resenting, oh, why did they have to release that? I mean, for one thing, I mean, at most, it's going to be like $18. I'll just wait for a 50% off deal. Sometimes I get complimentary copies through the website to do a review and stuff. But for the most part, I really do genuinely find something to appreciate about just about every one of these films. There hasn't been one that I hated. So, yeah, I can enjoy Tiny Furniture. I can even enjoy the old Blu-ray of Armageddon or whatever else, you know, the hated Criterion releases are out there. And there's some that leave me like, okay, whatever, that was great, you know, move on. And it's just the satisfaction of having that full run. So yeah, that sort of collector's itch, you know, just to have them all, you know, that's I guess it's kind of a human nature thing, or just part of my personality. I like having the complete set.
Yeah, and I'd say 90% of the time, and in fact, probably higher, the films I really, really enjoy.
Yeah.
Apu trilogy last year. That's probably one of the benchmark releases of this decade, maybe.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and especially the work that they put into the actual film preservation. They're not just releasing end product. They're doing a lot of stuff behind the scenes. They're collecting the actual, you know, archival copies and going back to the negatives and getting the best available materials so that they themselves are doing the preservation work. So on a historic and kind of, you know, I don't know, even like a technical level, they're contributing quite a bit to the preservation of cinema. So, you know, it's a great organization, and they really did, you know, they got into this. Well, Janus Films was one of the great distributors of art house cinema back in the 60s, and then they got into the whole Laserdisc thing. And so, yeah, if you love cinema, I mean, Criterion really is kind of foundational to that.
Absolutely, yeah. I, as someone who's not a big collector of physical media anymore, even I appreciate it, and I'm so grateful to Criterion because they do take on these restoration projects, the Apu trilogy being a pretty notable one since we just did a podcast on Path of Panjali. And it's also, again, the curation of cinema history is important. It's an enormous undertaking at this point. There's so many essential titles, and Criterion is such a great place to start, if nothing else.
They have 800 and counting, so
that's a lot.
It's scary though. Like, you really start digging into how many films were produced over the decades, and you realize how much of a drop in the water that is, though. Like,
yeah,
it's a little bit
true.
Scary how many films will disappear and won't survive the next couple decades, I think. Like, I don't know about physical media for home video use, but I think definitely for archival purposes, I think some films, their only shot at surviving maybe into the next half century or century will be that they exist physically in some way, ideally as a film print. You know, now we have films that are shot digitally, edited digitally, delivered digitally. They only exist as data. And I can't realistically imagine that those will survive in any appreciable condition into the next couple decades.
Yeah. Oh my God. Every time this you're not the first person to bring this up, but every time it comes up, it just makes me, like, it makes my stomach clench. Like, what are we going to lose? Yeah,
we might lose Zoolander. Who knows?
I won't allow it. You guys probably have a better sense of this than I do. Do you think that the market is still pretty strong for physical media, all things considered?
Well, you know, we've had conversations about this on our Criterion Cast podcast about, you know, is the audience drying up in a certain way? Are people content just to stream films and move on from one thing to the next? I think even a company that's as established and really, you know, respected in so many ways as Criterion, you know, we've talked a little bit about how they've had to kind of, you know, cut back on some of the lavishness of some of their packages, or they have to kind of sometimes reach a little bit more into obvious commercial type of releases, genre horror or things that kind of have more of a, like, a nostalgia appeal to, you know, Gen Xers or things like that. And so, you know, at what point do they maybe stop releasing some of the more, you know, cutting edge or obscure stuff on physical media? And when or if will Criterion have to think about doing more with, you know, streaming? I mean, they do have a channel on Hulu and stuff, but, you know, there may be a time where they have to shift more of their, you know, curation towards, you know, the emerging markets that aren't as physically media based. So I'm sure they face a lot of challenges, just like every other, you know, book publisher, magazine. But I certainly want to promote to people, you know, there is something nice about the physicality. I mean, I've even thought about myself, you know, like my blog and my podcasting, maybe I'd like to have those burned onto some kind of media so that if the website ever crashes or for whatever reason, I've still got some record, you know, that I can pass on.
Yeah, I think we need to do a 4K restoration of David's podcasting.
Yeah, or I'm putting our podcast on vinyl. How about that? Yeah,
there you go.
Yeah, no, I think the vinyl comparison is a good one because there is this, I don't know if it's nostalgia or if it's some other deeper longing. I don't know if we have time for psychoanalysis right now, but there does seem to be still this lingering fondness for collecting and sort of like fetishizing the physical medium and like the even just like cover art. People seem to enjoy the holding things in their hands still, and I don't know if the effect is like actually all that different. But it feels different.
Well, there's a community aspect. I mean, some of the films, like, you know, the 15th of every month, Criterion announces their releases that are going to come out 3 months in the future. And, you know, a lot of the films that we get excited and jazzed about to talk about, well, they're already available on Hulu. You know, it's like, if you want to watch them, just click on your Roku box or get online or whatever, and there they are. But now that it's becoming an official Criterion release, the community interest, and we're going to talk about it on an upcoming podcast, or we're all going to bring it home or show the the pictures of our latest acquisitions on Instagram or whatever, there's just kind of an excitement because we're all sort of having this shared experience of enjoying this film in approximately, you know, the same time as we get it in. And even the ritual, just putting it in the player and hitting play and watching the opening menus. I mean, there's just a formality, a fetishism, if you will. I think that's a good word.
It's a great word.
Let's own it, you know.
All right. Well, I think I want to end with maybe Aaron, make a final pitch. Why should people buy Criterion?
They're great films and they're great presentations, and you kind of learn about the context in which the movie's made. So yeah, I think Criterion is generally the best physical product that you can buy to experience a classic film, historic film.
All right, perfect. Okay. Yeah. All right, I think we've had a pretty fun show so far, but just for good measure, let's close things out with a few final notes of positivity. David, what's one? Yeah, how about we start with you, David?
Well,
piece of art, website, article, whatever.
Well, I've got a couple notes of positivity. I guess they're also self-promotional. I spent a lot of time this past week watching Italian melodramas of the late 40s and early 1950s, directed by a guy named Raffaello Matarazzo. He was not a great auteur. He's not somebody that, you know, went on to achieve greatness in cinema, but he did have a pretty high-flying run of it in the commercial ventures of kind of Italian society and pop culture in these very lurid melodramas. And so I discussed four of them with my friend Trevor Baird on the Eclipse Viewer podcast. The other thing I spent this past week doing was watching Stan Brakhage, a name I mentioned earlier. So for listeners not familiar, he did a lot of very radical experimental cinema in the 1950s, the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and these films are really, really far out there. But I've reviewed the films that he created in 1967, and so that's my latest blog entry on Criterion Reflections. My most positive thing is just I'm really happy to finally be on this FlixWise podcast. It's a great listen, and I appreciate the work you're doing, Pauline. And really, really nice to contribute here. So I look forward to getting you on one of our Eclipse Viewer podcasts. We've got some plans for that. So we'll be talking again. All right.
I look forward to it. All right, Aaron. How about you?
I'm taking a different avenue from David, just because I talk about Criterions on every other corner of the internet. So I'll say that for TV, my recent I don't know if obsession is the word, but my recent indulgence is Rick and Morty, which is Dan Harmon and Justin Roiland. It's an animated, like 20-minute episodes. I think it's Adult Swim. And David Harmon did Community, if you know that show. It's kind of in that vein, but there's lots of pop cultural references. There's one about Zardoz I saw the other day, and there's lots more, and it's just so much. It's kind of science-y, but not like, you know, not like Star Trek kind of. It's more just far out science-y. Yeah. So that's been a lot of fun.
Yes, and you are not the first person to recommend Rick and Morty on this show. It was another final note caught like a year ago or so, probably more.
Oh, right. Okay, great.
So yeah.
People
seem to like it, yeah. Martin, positive.
So the Art Gallery of Ontario has an exhibit on J.M.W. Turner's paintings.
Oh, great.
Which were amazing to see in person. If anyone's listened to the Andre Rublev episode, they'll know I really like Turner's artwork. And it was just sort of amazing to see like his, especially his paintings, watercolor paintings of continental Europe, I thought were really incredible.
Yeah. So my final note, we've been talking a lot about the specific mediums on which to watch movies and whether streaming is the appropriate way or whether, you know, DVD or film. But I just want to quickly say that most of the time, just watching the movie is good enough no matter the format. But there are some exceptions. And fortunately, I'm very fortunate to live in a city that has frequent showings of popular movies in 70mm. So several times a year, our Cinematheque will show usually Vertigo and Lawrence of Arabia in 70mm, sometimes Playtime. But I just want to say that if you have not seen Lawrence of Arabia in 70mm, you have not seen it.
I agree. I haven't seen it, and I agree. Yeah. I haven't seen it in 70. I've seen the movie about five times.
But have you really seen it?
Nope.
I know. If you watch it on DVD, like, you wouldn't know that there's people in the film.
Yeah, exactly.
It's just long shots of desert. Yeah. So.
Like, is it's that Omar true. Sharif? I can't tell.
No, it's a camel.
Yeah, exactly. Pretty much. But yeah, anytime it comes to town, I always try and make an effort to go and see it. And my final note is kind of a sad note, but I'm choosing to feel happy about it. The last time I tried to go see Lawrence of Arabia at the Cinematheque, it was sold out, and I couldn't get in.
Mm.
So in a way, it's sad because I didn't get a chance to see it this time around, but it's also kind of heartening to know that there are still so many people who appreciate seeing Lawrence of Arabia in the theater in this format. So I'm going to choose to feel happy about it.
The world's a little better place than we might have thought it was otherwise.
Right? Exactly. Exactly.
And there have been a lot of things, positive and negative, said about Tarantino's Hateful Eight, 70mm. But actually, I think one of the positives is that more theaters are now equipped for 70mm. So maybe more cities will get Lawrence of Arabia and or others. So that's happy.
Yeah,
maybe.
Exactly. Here's
poor
hoping.
Theaters.
I know. And that's the way we frame it, FlixWise, that is. Listeners, what do you think of Playtime? Come let us know on our website, FlixWise.com. And if you want to weigh in on the Blu-ray versus streaming debate, you can like us and leave us a comment on Facebook at Facebook.com/FlixWise. Also, you can come pal around with me on Twitter. The handle is @FlixWise. And speaking of streaming services, before you do any of that social media stuff, please rate us and leave us a nice little comment on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Help our little show get some attention. All right, guys, it seems playtime is over.
No.
It might be nap time.
Back to reality.
Nap time! But before we go, David, it was a pleasure having you on the show.
Oh, delight, definitely.
Absolutely. Can you just go ahead and remind listeners where they can find your writing and your podcasting? And
okay, well, my blog is Criterion Reflections. Just Google that, but it's Criterion Reflections, all one word, blogspot.com, if you want to know the whole address. Otherwise, I do a lot of stuff at Criterion Cast, so just hit Criterion Cast, where you'll see a very variety of podcasts that I do. I'm pretty much a regular on the newsstand. I also do kind of their main episodes with Scott and I. And I'm just getting around in the podcasting world, and that's where you'll find me.
Perfect. Aaron, thanks for coming back on the show.
Yeah, it's been a while. Watership
yes, it
down.
Has. Yeah. I know. And where can folks find your stuff?
Well, the podcast, I've kind of gotten rid of the blogging, but you can find me at CriterionCloseUp.com, and you can find me on Twitter, AWest505, and also on CriterionCast. In fact, if you want to subscribe to CriterionCast, subscribe to the main feed, and you'll get my show, David's show, all of our shows, so I recommend that.
All right, perfect. Martin.
Lady P.
I know you prefer to remain a recluse, but...
people can find me in Toronto.
Yes, they can come find you in person.
I'm around. You can spot me like Mr. Hello.
But otherwise, social media stuff?
If people are inclined, they can follow me on Twitter at Movie Kessler. And I tweet about movies and things mostly. Yeah.
Perfect. And, you know, they can often find you on this podcast.
At Flixwise Podcast, if you haven't heard.
All right. Yeah. And for listeners, just we'll update our social media site and Twitter for more info on the movie that we're going to be talking about next. But until then, I guess we have to say à plus tard. Huh?
C'est bon.
C'est bon. All right, bye guys.
Au revoir.
Au revoir. So, surprise, listeners, we're back for more. As you know, you have just listened to our Playtime episode, and our guest, David Blakesley, has spent much of the episode talking about his illustrious blog, Criterion Reflections. But shortly before we put out this episode, I found out that David has plans to discontinue that blog. So I just quickly want to get into that announcement and maybe update the listeners about where you can now find his material. So, David... What happened?
Well, a few different things have happened, and this is all for the good. I'm not going to take my Criterion Reflections blog down. Those posts that have been going since actually 2008 is when I started it, just kind of a random blog at the time. But 2009 is when I got that chronological thing started, right after New Year's Day of that year. I've decided that I'm going to kind of make a transition and start publishing my stuff over on the Criterion Cast website, which has been sort of my second home on the internet. And there's a few different reasons. I guess I'll just kind of shoot them out there really quickly. One, the format of the blogspot.com site and just the idea of just writing these kind of blocky, texty essays has started to feel a little bit worn out for me. I do want to really continue the chronological series, though. I am going to keep my stream going of covering the films of 1968, which I think was kind of what I was talking about even at the time of recording the Playtime episode a while back. So that will continue, but I'm going to start doing it in a different way, maybe making the posts a little bit shorter on the written side, doing some short podcast type of things. It might be just me doing a solo thing for 5 or 10 minutes. It might be hooking up with a friend who wants to talk about that particular movie. It might be me clustering several films together and capsule reviews if it seems like they kind of fit. But I will be maintaining the chronological scheme. I still have my timeline, my Criterion chronology list over on Letterboxd. And, you know, I will be methodically working my way through the films of the Criterion Collection, basically just doing it in a different location and with a few more creative options at my disposal. It seems like it's just a nice transitional step for me to take, and I appreciate the chance to talk about that a little bit here.
So, in short, you're not going anywhere.
Oh, no, not really quitting. And no, I'm not doing this with any kind of a sense of discouragement or burnout. Fatigue may be just the sense of a certain way of going about my blogging. And so this is a chance to just kind of reboot and re-energize and, you know, continue the quest, you know, continue the series, but in a new environment.
Perfect. Excellent. All right. Well, in that case, where can listeners now find your content, your thoughts.
Well, sure. Well, if you want to read my old stuff, you just still go to Criterion Reflections. That's going to be there. And what I'm going to be doing now is going over to CriterionCast.com, which is a place where I do a lot of podcasting, and there's a lot of contributors. That's the other thing. It's a pretty lively website, and I think there's been a lot of collaborative stuff going on. You know, Aaron and Mark Herney have joined up with their Criterion Close-Up podcast. Another caster, Arik Devins with the Cinema Gadfly, you know, he and I collaborated not too long ago on a couple discussions about Chungking Express and Reality Bites. Those just got published recently.
Yeah,
and Arik has become a part of the Criterion Cast Network. We're affiliated with the Masters of Cinema Cast, coming out of, like, I think Norway and England. So it's a pretty cool little, you know, group of writers and thinkers over there. Criterion Cast has really kind of grown and evolved since I got involved back with it in 2010. A lot of new personalities have come into the mix. It's a great bunch of folks, and I'm very happy to be part of that and to build the brand a little bit and to benefit from the association.
Perfect. Excellent. All right. Well, enjoy your new, or I guess your... should we say revamped partnership?
Yeah, I think I'm just kind of moving from one of the side offices to one of the corner suites.
There you go, yeah. I like that. Well, as long as you still find time to hang out with us non-Criterion folks.
Oh, absolutely. And that's another thing. This is going to be a great platform, because even Criterion Cast covers a lot of other types of films. Mostly, I mean, as far as the newer releases, the art house indie type of stuff. But, you know, we venture into new territory, and very happy that you've given me a chance to connect, and I know we've got some plans for you to come over our way on the Eclipse Viewer, so
that's
another little tantalizing hint to throw out there for your listeners. Looking forward to that in the month or so ahead.